About time to get started here. We're glad to have each and every one here. We've got a good class tonight and several visitors. Glad to have you with us. We're studying the captivity and return from captivity and the years of silence this particular quarter. And as those of you who've been in here, you can tell that it's a pretty difficult time to study because there's so much history involved in it rather than a lot of scripture. So anyway, I hope that we can glean something from it tonight in our studies. Tonight we'll be basically talking a little bit about Syria, Egypt, or Greek, the Grecians, and the Jews. There's some preliminary things to look at. These 400 years are best viewed as a transitional period, basically. And the Greek language is becoming the dominant language. And there are more educated people by this time than had ever been before. Because human reasoning was prized by the Greeks. They thought this was the thing to be able to do, was to be able to reason. And the only way to do that is, of course, know how to read and those kind of things. So each man had the right to think for himself. And you'd think up to this point they didn't have that. But they needed to be able to do that to be educated. And so the Greek language is one of the most precise languages the world has ever known. And it's the wealth of vocabulary, synonyms, exact shades of meanings could be expressed, pretenses, precise tenses, sentence arrangements was almost endless. And all of these things made it ideal language for God's final revelation to the world. And just for an example of that, think about just the word love. To us, you know, I can love the fish, you know. I can love my wife. I can love whatever it might be. But you use the same word here. I mean, we do, for all of those different meanings, you know, and we kind of know what it's talking about, you know, but the Greek language was so much more precise. Here's an example. Eros, that was the word for love. That means the sexual passion or intense love. Phila, like Philadelphia. It was a deep friendship, or warm and tender love. Ludus was a playful love. Agape, that was unconditional love. Pragma was a long-standing love. And Philetia was a love of self. That's six different meanings for the word love. And we just use love, you know. So you can see what it's talking about. It was a very precise language. And there are several places in the New Testament where love is used. You remember Jesus asked Peter, "Lovest thou me?" You know, and he used different answers as he responded back to Jesus. Well, that was really convenient, or better yet, should I say, it was the providence of God that brought this Greek language to the forefront at this time. Due to change of the dominant language spoken there are changes concerning names of people and places that the Old Testament talks about, and compared to the New Testament spelling, different pronunciations and those kind of things, as we see on the map, and it's hard to tell it. You might see it better there. Judea, that in Old Testament times was Judah. So they changed it to Judea. And Idumea, that was Edom back in old times. Yeah, that was the children of Esau. But there are other names that we know of, that Elijah is Elias, and those different names in the New Testament now that different from what it was in the Old Testament. There are more besides. But the sea trade became more important, and most of the ports were north of Mount Carmel. And that's Mount Carmel, that little point that's sticking out right there. Most of them went into Tyre and Sidon, were seaports, and then on up further were the areas in Phoenicia. Herod the Great, however, had an artificial harbor made down in Caesarea, and that brought trade on down in that area. Now, as we look at a little bit further here, we find that the 400 years are best viewed as traditional. The effects of this historical period still seen in the New Testament activities of the church, even Roman advancement in travel and roads, and the precise language of the New Testament. Possibly you might look at Galatians 4:4, and there it is up there for you. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons, referring to the Gentiles that were adopted at a later point. This lesson focuses on how the Jews actually fared under the competing empires resulting from Alexander the Great's death. And we'll get into that in just a few minutes. So we're going to be talking about the threads of Syria, Greek, and also of the Jews. Syria was ruled by Seleucus Nicator, and he was Alexander's general. He was Alexander's, one of his generals. He had about four different generals. He was the founder of the Seleucid dynasty. He was an admiral for the Ptolemy navy, and he built the city of Antioch of Syria on the Orontes River. And we'll look at that in just a few minutes. He made it his capital, and Antioch grew to be the third largest city of Roman Empire. The harbor at Seleucia was the harbor where supplies and trade came from the ships that had docked there. The territory of Seleucus Nicator included Thrace, Southern Asia Minor, Babylon, and Media. And to give you an idea where that's at, you see where Judea is, and Thrace is up there, Southern Assyria right there, Babylon, of course, is over there, and Media is up in that area right there. So that gives you an idea of where all that Sluice had their reign over. This is the Antioch of Syria that we talked about, where that was the capital that Nicanor had actually set up, Seleucus Nicanor, and also another seaport that we know about. Another seaport is Seleucia, and that's found in Acts 13, verse 4. And that's the place where, you remember, Paul started his first missionary journey. Paul and Barnabas went out on the first missionary journey. And they went from there over to Salamis and to Paphos and on up to Persia and up in that area, southern Asia then. So we find an empire that would last about till BC 64, when it lasted till that long, the Seleucid kings did. There was a major threat gaining strength in western Syria, and that was Rome. And it'll be the ruling empire in time to come. Now we want to look at the kind of the reign of the Egyptians or Grecians, ruled by Ptolemy Soter. He was another one of Alexander's generals. He was the founder of the Ptolemies. He was the main territory was in Egypt, and they also claimed Judea. The capital city was Alexandria, and we'll look at that in just a moment. Alexander's model city that he personally marked out in the Western Delta. It was an important center. Alexandria was an important center for the arts, for research, and libraries. Though they were Greek in their outlook, they did not force philosophies on other people. The Jews were allowed to keep their form of worship and also their lifestyle. Alexandria became one of the major centers for Judaism. More and more, the Jews used the language of the land and found it hard to read their original language, which was Hebrew. They finally got to the point where they had trouble reading Hebrew. You understand that we looked at last time how the ones that had come back from captivity and married some of these other nations, and they were speaking like Hebrew and Ammonite language of the Ammonites and the Moabites and different ones, that we found that they were speaking two different languages, and some of the children, they only knew the language of the other people, not the Hebrews. They learned those. Well, we find this is the map, and it's got Egypt where the near Alexander, the Ptolemy Soter was over, and also Alexandria is right at that point right there. And that was a major place, and still is, as far as that goes. A lot of things, I'm sure, are still there in some of the ruins, probably. And we got some folks here that knows about the ruins. We're glad to have the Duttons with us. They've been over there digging in the land in times past, and so glad to have them with us. We find that they were tolerant of the Jewish religious practices. And this is when about 200 BC, the Septuagint version was actually written. And it was written by, they say, by 70 Jewish, the Jewish legend has it, that 72 scholars completed the translation of the Septuagint version from Hebrew in 72 days. Well, that's probably not true, but that's the Jewish legend that says that. But Syria took control of Judah, and Egypt continued as a major force in the world affairs, but did not have much effect on Syria after Syria took control. We see that Paul, in his third journey, when he came back, he went through Ptolemais. And in Acts 21, it talks about that, and they were still prominent in the city there. The background, battlegrounds between Syria and Egypt calls to mind the previous studies that we read about in the prophecies, God's people and how they were going to be affected in Daniel 7 through 12. The visions of the four beasts, if you remember, the succession of four worldly empires describing events up to and after the fourth beast, that would have been Rome, very similar to Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel, the second chapter. Superiority of God's kingdom over the kingdom of men, and also the presentation of Christ as the Son of Man in the ancient days, Acts 1, verse 9 and following, and Revelations, the fourth and fifth chapters, who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose the seals. And it also the line of the tribe of Judah, who was the lamb that was able to do that. But as we look at the vision of the ram and goat, the overthrow of the Medes and the Persians by the Greek, describing the events between Babylon and Rome, a transfer of power, more or less, and the Medes and the Persians to the Greek Macedonians. They fall to Alexander the Great and rise, and that would be the fourth kingdom, more or less. Most likely, the little horn that it talked about was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was cruel, his cruel treatment of the Jews, defiling the temple. We'll get into that a little bit more. It eventually led to the Maccabean Revolt in 167 to 164. I got a book from Charles Pfeiffer, and here are some details about the Maccabean Revolt. We'll go into it a little bit more next class. But the Maccabean Revolt is the oppression of the Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes. He produced a reaction that actually stunned himself as well as the Jews. What the Jews needed at this particular time was a leader. And so one emerged from the village of Modin. And his name was Mattathias Maccabees. An emissary of Antiochus erected a pagan altar in Modin. In order to show loyalty to the Jews, he asked them to come forward and sacrifice to this altar. But you see what's happening to the Jewish people right here. I mean, they're just totally being asked to worship idols, basically. And so the aged priest of the village was asked to come first and set a good example. It makes sense. But Mattathias, who was the high priest at that time, refused. And so this kind of begins the Maccabean revolt. A little later, as the revolt worsened and the struggles against the authority turned into a guerrilla warfare. Does that ring a bell today, of guerrilla warfare going on over in that area? I mean, it's still going on, you know. The sons of Mattathias would hide in the mountains. You remember seeing that happening today too, don't you? They would hide in the mountains. They would come out of their strongholds at night, raid the towns and villages, killing the royal officers and the Hellenistic Jews who supported them. A religious factor favored the Syrians, however, because the Maccabees would not fight on the Sabbath day. That makes sense. At least they adhere to some of God's law, whether all of it or not, I don't know. But on one Sabbath, a band of Maccabees were surrounded by the Syrians and they slaughtered them, and they could not defend themselves because it was the Sabbath. Well, Mattathias realized that they could just kill all of us off. And so he adopted the principle that fighting in self-defense was permissible even on the Sabbath. So Mattathias died, and his son Judas took over his leadership. The Syrians underestimated the strength of the Maccabees. Only they were going to send a detachment there to go against them, and they sent some inferior generals and a small detachment there to try to put them down, more or less. And so that didn't happen. So Antiochus realized that he had a full-size rebellion on his hand. However, he could not throw his full strength to Judea. And you'd think, well, why not? I mean, that's, he correct all them folks right quick, you know. Well, the problem was he faced another revolt in Parthia, which is a different section of the country. Antiochus left his general Lysias to handle the matter there in Judea. He gathered up an army, but Judas found out about it. Judas Maccabees found out about it, and he surprised attacked him at night, Lysias, and annihilated most of the Syrian army and seized an enormous amount of booty or wealth, you know, at that particular time. Judas and his army moved toward Jerusalem, and the Syrians fled. The Maccabees took almost all the city. They removed the pagan, everything that looked like paganism that had been installed. They removed all of that. The altar dedicated to Jupiter was taken down, and a new altar was erected to the God of Israel. So you can kind of see they're trying their best to get back to worshiping God. Yeah, it's not going to work, though. The statue of Zeus and Antiochus was also torn down, and it was ground into dust. And so they were trying to wipe it all out, and they were finally able to observe an 8-day feast of dedication, first time in, it might have been the first time, I'm not sure, but we know it today as Hanukkah. And it's also called the Festival of Lights. So this is some of the first that I've read about of Hanukkah being actually, and it may be before that. Do you know, Steve, how far back it went? Okay, good. So it was about this was the first time that Hanukkah was actually observed at this particular time. The neighboring land all around Judea were sympathetic towards the Syrians, which that's not uncommon. They've always been against Israel to do anything, but they had been against the Jews all along. Peace was short-lived there, And Lysias finally marched again against the Maccabees and defeated them near Jerusalem. He thought to besiege the city of Jerusalem, hoping to starve them into submission. However, he learned about the same time he was fixing to do that, that there was a threat against Antioch of Syria at that particular time, which was the capital, if you remember. And so Lysias made an offer of peace to the those in Jerusalem, in Judea. And here was the options they had if they would accept it. He would refrain from their internal affairs so they could kind of rule things. Laws against observance of Judaism was repealed so they could worship as they wanted to. The high priest given to them was Jachin, or known also as Eliakim, and also known as Alcimus. By the way, he's Greek. Now that tells you a little bit about their high priest situation too. But Judas and his followers would not be punished. They'd let them go. The walls of Jerusalem, however, were raised. In other words, they were pretty well torn down. The peace terms were accepted by the Hasidim, or the leaders of Judea. And they voted Judas and his followers out. You know, they overruled them. Judas and his followers left the city, fearing a reprisal from the high priest Alcimus. Well, that's exactly what happened. They were all seized and they were executed. Loyal Jews turned back to Judas again, and civil war was renewed. Judas made war against Syria. Also, Alcimus was Judas made war against Syria, who Alcimus had actually called Syria to come and help to go against these men. Judas only had about 800 men following him, and he got killed during that war. His brothers, Jonathan, Simon, and Johanan Maccabees, took over. Many of the Jews began to follow Jonathan and his band. Syria tried their best to destroy him, but were not successful. Simon Maccabees became high priest, certainly not a Levite, I'm sure, and the legitimacy of the Maccabean priest was settled when the leaders of Israel named Simon as leader and high priest. Simon and his two sons were murdered by his son-in-law. And this kind of thing went on and on and on. Somebody killed somebody, somebody killed somebody. So anyway, the third son of Simon, named John Hyrcanus, however, escaped and succeeded his father as hereditary head of the Jewish state in 134 BC. That gives you just a little brief summary of the Maccabean revolt. And I'm sorry it took so long, but that's just as short, and I condensed it a whole lot just to get that part of it. So anyway, as we look at Daniel 10 through 12, we look at the fourth king after Cyrus. If you remember, that was Xerxes. He decided to attack Greece, and Alexander the Great responded, and he was defeating the Persian forces. Almost as quickly as he gained victory, Alexander died at age 32, and his kingdom was divided into four of his generals. And if you remember, two of them was the Ptolemy, was led by Alexander, and the Seleucid Empire was led by Seleucus. And under Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucids finally gained control. Antiochus Epiphanes used Palestine as a staging area to attack Egypt on several occasions. When defeated, he would mistreat the Jews, and eventually the Jews revolt, the Maccabean revolt. Finally, Rome gained power from the west and controlled both the Ptolemies and the Seleucid. And of course, Rome destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. Rome could not crush the spiritual kingdom spoken of numerous times by the prophets. In Daniel 11th chapter, verse 15 and following, you can read about the king of the north coming and building a siege mound and those kind of things that just follows right along what we've been talking about happening to area around Jerusalem. So the effects of Hellenism or Greek culture mainly seen in the ability to read, to speak worldwide. The ability would eventually result in proselytes understanding the scriptures. They could read this New Testament by the Septuagint version. They could understand it. And Jesus and his apostles used this quite extensively as well. You recall Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel, the second chapter. Daniel's vision of the beast in Daniel 7. Legend says that Rome was founded about 753 B.C. They were not very strong at that point. They were just little city-states here and there. A power that would eventually spread to the east. They would be a very strong power. It played out in the Ptolemaic War, Rome's victories over Carthage that opened the doors for her spread eastward into the Mediterranean, and that was around 146 BC and also after that. You remember the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream that Daniel interpreted for him. You remember the head was Babylon. It was of gold. And the chest area and arms were silver. The thighs and hips were bronze. And the legs and feet were iron and iron and clay. Of course, the Babylonian leader was Nebuchadnezzar. Cyrus was the Medo-Persian, and Alexander the Grecian, and Pompey, as best I can determine. Is that correct? Was it Pompey? Is that correct, the Roman? That's what I could determine anyway. If that's not right, I'm sorry. But that's what I, in my reading, I found out. Remember what was said in the scripture. And these days, and in these days, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. If you remember, that was said in the book of Daniel, the second chapter. All of these particular empires were all gone, and now you have the Romans there, and you remember the stone that was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that stone began to grow and grow and grow, and that was the kingdom of Christ that would eventually cover the entire world, and that kingdom would last forever. This is Rome and Carthage, where the Romans actually had their beginning wars, kind of. And then from that point, from Carthage, they began to take other areas around in the Mediterranean Sea. Rome grew about the time the Old Testament closed, around 390 B.C., Rome began the Punic War about 219, and Hannibal of Carthage resisted the uprising. He took his troops using trained elephants. I couldn't believe when I read that. Using trained elephants to go over the Alps, which put him in the heart of Rome. That just kind of blew my mind when I found that. But to use elephants up through the Alps, just, you know, you think of elephants down in Africa or somewhere, you just don't think of them being up that way. But anyway, the Punic War, the third war, was from 149 to 146. Rome turned its attention eastward toward the Mediterranean world and pretty well takes over. And so we're going to find out a little more about the Maccabees in the next lesson when David can do a really good job. And that'll be on the Lord's Day. That's all I've got for tonight. So I appreciate you. I'm sorry it was so much material, but that was the only way to do this. I'm sorry. But thank you for listening.